everyone, and welcome to another episode of UFOs and the Paranormal. I'm your host, Preston Dennett, and each week we talk about UFOs or the supernatural, whether it's ghosts, UFOs, near-death experiences, past lives, anything like this. This is what we talk about. And tonight, we have a very interesting guest. His name is Bruce Hennigan. He's an author. And we're going to be talking about his novel, which has just been published, called The 13th Demon. And we're going to talk about how science, can it reconcile with the belief in demons and angels and religion and all of this. We've got a lot of very interesting things to discuss. But first, I want to talk a little bit about some interesting news that's going on. I've got some very, very interesting reports. I think one of the most interesting is the discovery of a new planet. This is apparently 20 light years away. It's called Gliese 581, and scientists are really excited about it because although they've discovered about 200 planets outside our own solar system, this is one of the first that appears to have water on it. And water is, of course, vital for life, and this might be one of the first planets capable of actually supporting life. And it does seem to be very Earth-like, about the same size of Earth, a little bit larger. Most of the other planets found have been gas giants, and this appears to be a solid Earth-like planet. So it's pretty exciting stuff. I don't think we're going to be going there anytime soon, at least not officially. Now, whether they're a member of the secret military and are flying around these UFOs that have allegedly been captured by the military, that's another story, because they're... those stories are actually circulating. Project SERPA, in particular, claims that military personnel have, in fact, flown to other planets using UFO technology. I don't know. We'll have to wait for that one. Another piece of interesting news comes from Don Ecker, who is the co-editor of UFO Magazine with his wife, Vicky Ecker. Well, he has just announced that he is quitting the UFO business. Every now and then, a major UFO researcher decides to just drop out. They get sick and tired, I guess, of the politics. And here's a short quote from him. This is why he's dropping out, and I'm quoting now. "One thing that I've discovered being in this field for 20 years is a very simple truth, but a truth that is most profound. Most researchers are ignorant of what has happened previously in the field of UFO research. They're ignorant of the claims made in the past, ignorant of past hoaxes perpetrated by players in the field, and are intolerant of views that conflict with their deep-seated, erroneous beliefs. Quite frankly, I've grown tired of this field. I'm tired of the media that is blinded by their prejudice about UFOs, their snide and condescending remarks about something that, quite frankly, they know nothing about. I'm tired of people claiming to be researchers that refuse to accept the truth about something regardless of how many times it jumps up and bites them in the ass." And he goes on for quite a while. And, I can sympathize with a lot of what he's saying, but I don't think it's any different in any other field. And this field needs good researchers, so, well, I'm glad he's contributed what he has, and hopefully more people will come in to take his place. And here's another interesting piece of news, which I didn't know about, but a Mick Jagger is another celebrity who has now come out of the UFO closet claiming he has seen a UFO. A number of musicians have already claimed this. John Lennon, of course, had a very well-known sighting in the 1970s, I believe, over New York City. But Mick Jagger apparently has been interested in UFOs for many years, and in 1968, he went camping in Glastonbury, England, with his then-girlfriend, singer Marianne Faithfull, and encountered a rare, luminous, cigar-shaped mother ship. And around this time, he had a UFO detector installed at his British estate. And this alarm, this UFO detector, apparently kept going off whenever he left his home, apparently indicating the presence of one of these UFOs around. Mick Jagger also claims to have seen a UFO over the crowd while he was in a concert in the 1969 Altamont concert in California. And his guitarist, Keith Richards, also admits to having seen a few aliens, or UFOs. So this is pretty interesting. Jimi Hendrix is another very famous musician who has seen UFOs. Could it be that these ETs are trying to influence people who are having a profound influence on society? I don't know if I'd go that far, but it's interesting nevertheless. Finally, I want to tell you about a really interesting sighting that was reported to me recently. As many of my listeners know, I've done a lot of research into UFO activity off the Southern California coast area. This started out in the late 1980s when I was researching a UFO wave over Topanga Canyon, and actually 1992. I started to get a lot of reports of underwater UFOs in this area. And as the years passed, I collected more and more reports, and I finally decided I'd do a serious investigation into it. And I found out that all the other researchers here in Southern California have a bunch of these kinds of reports. And I put them all together, and I wrote an article for Fate magazine, Is There an Underwater UFO Base Off the Southern California Coast? Now, the article had a huge effect. A lot of people contacted me afterwards telling me more of their accounts of underwater UFOs in this area. The History Channel contacted me, and I actually appeared on a segment about this subject, which brought in a bunch more reports. So now I have enough reports to fill a book, really, of these ocean-going UFOs in this one area in the Santa Catalina Channel. And I just recently got another report that I want to tell you about. This is from an anonymous gentleman. He absolutely does not want his name used. He's a lawyer. He's in his 50s. And I'll just read you what he wrote to me. I asked him for a description of his sighting, and he wrote a very lucid letter. And here is what he said. He said, "My sighting occurred on Friday, August 4th, 2006, at around 11:30 p.m. or so. I am certain of the date because it was the anniversary date of me and my ex-wife. I had driven down to one of the beach parking lots in Long Beach to watch the stars and waves, as I often do. An object coming from the west around the San Pedro area caught my attention. It was white and moving somewhat faster than a plane would have. It continued southeast towards the many oil islands off the coast of Long Beach. It changed colors from white to a very cool and neat blue color as it slowed down and started hovering over the water. It is hard to guess how far away it was, especially at night and over the ocean, but it was probably about a mile or so offshore, as it was further out than the breakwaters and oil islands. Size-wise, I can only guess that it was much larger than a helicopter or a small plane, but its shape made it hard to guess size. It was triangular in shape, but with what seemed like soft, rounded edges. The glow it gave off and the reflection off of the water did not show any hard edges. As it slowly rotated, it seemed to have this triangular shape. It was quite bright blue as it rotated, and I could tell it was rotating because the blue lights would be interrupted three times at equal intervals. There might have been a blue light on the underside, but I could not tell. After about 15 seconds or so, it rose higher and changed color to a reddish orange and zipped off towards Catalina Island very quickly and then disappeared as it continued to rise and move away. It made no noise. At first, I thought it was some kind of night rescue helicopter or something, but it went to one spot, hovered, and then took off. The size and the colors did not seem right. What the hell is going on? Why doesn't the press investigate this stuff with any energy? This whole thing gives me both a creepy and exciting feeling. Yours truly." So that's a pretty interesting sighting, and it's only one of so many I'm receiving. Another really interesting report in the Catalina area involves a lady who was going on a glass-bottom boat tour when they saw actually a bright light object through the bottom of the boat. And as they were going on this boat, the boat suddenly stopped and would not move. It was as if it was being held in place, and suddenly the light flicked off and the boat was on its way again. So I think there is an underwater base there. That's just my opinion. I've got a lot of reasons to believe that, but I don't want to go into that now. Tonight, I want to talk about The 13th Demon, The Altar of the Spiral Eye, a novel by our guest, Bruce Hennigan. Okay, now let me see. I have his bio right here. Now, Bruce Hannigan has written hundreds of plays and articles and is the co-author of Conquering Depression. He currently resides in Shreveport, Louisiana, with his wife and two children. And the 13th theme in this book actually does have a website that if people want to go and check out more about it, it is, let me see, www.13thdemon.com. That's 13thdemon.com. Now, I don't know how many out there believe in demons or angels or good and evil. I certainly do. I've done a lot of research into this area. I've interviewed people who claim to have been possessed by demons. I've interviewed people who've been in very haunted houses that they think were haunted by these very evil spirits. I've investigated a lot of hauntings of this kind. And I've also talked to a lot of people who have had angelic encounters. So I know that this stuff is real. I think that people put a lot of different interpretations on it. I know it's very controversial, but I do think that there's something to it. Now, our guest tonight also is very educated about this. His book, The 13th Demon, tells the story of Jonathan Steele, a man without a past, who has amnesia, actually, who is vengefully searching for an elusive demonic force that had murdered his loved ones. He eventually traces it to a small church, which is plagued by this evil demon, and begins the quest to overcome this powerful evil force. And this is basically the thrust of the novel. And tonight we're going to talk about science and the belief in demon and angels using this novel as a backdrop. We're going to talk about how recent discoveries support belief in the supernatural, whether demonic possession is fact or fiction, if angels and demons do actually exist among us, and will this controversy over science versus religion in America ever be resolved? So that's what we're going to talk about tonight. Bruce, thank you very much for coming onto the show.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate that.
So the 13th demon, this is not the first thing you've written?
No, it's not. I wrote a book on depression for my own personal. I'm a physician, and I had personal experience with depression. And 6 years ago, I wrote a book, co-authored a book on depression. And I've also written quite a number of dramas and plays. And this is my first attempt at fiction. It's something I've dreamed of doing ever since I was a kid, when I used to watch all the scary movies in the afternoon when I came home from school. I've always dreamed of writing a horror novel or a science fiction novel. So this was my fun book that I got to write. I really enjoyed writing it. So
I'm good. Yeah, well, apparently you've put a lot of true stuff in here. I mean, in the sources in the back, you talk about how the basic events in this book are based from the work of religious scholars.
That's true. You know, one of my favorite science fiction authors is Michael Crichton, and I like the way he takes science and history, and he'll weave a story around it so it has a core of evidence and fact. And that's kind of what I wanted to do with this particular book. I wanted to address the issue you just touched on, the presence or reality of demons and angels, and the reality of good and evil. What do people think about that? Do we have any hard evidence for that? And I kind of told a story with that sort of at the heart of the story, because I want people. I just want people to be able to think about things and to challenge people's beliefs. I'm a firm believer that you should investigate what you believe in. It sounds like you're a very good investigator with that. You know, looking into all of these incidents, you should just don't take what somebody tells you at face value, but go out and test it and see what's going on and make sure the evidence is there. And that's kind of what I've done with the storyline.
Right, right. So what inspired you to write about this particular subject?
Well, when I was an intern, this had been about 15 years ago, I was working one night in the emergency room. We had a two-month rotation where we would see patients who came into the emergency room, and we had one room that we always set aside for psychiatric patients. and there were about four of us in a group, and we would take turns going and evaluating the psychiatric patient and then sending them up to the psychiatric floor. And one night it was my turn, and you don't mind if I tell this story to you, because this is kind of encounter with a demon-possessed person. This is what I want to kind of where a lot of this inspiration comes from. But it was my turn to go evaluate the patient, and we had this one room at the end of this long hallway that we reserved for the violent and, you know, kind of crazy patients. And when I started walking down the hall, there were policemen who normally would stand outside the room, but they were at my end of the hall. They wouldn't even go down to the end of the hall. And all the lights were busted out and were hanging by wires, and there was this mist kind of hanging in the air that was, you know, sparking and kind of glowing and from the electricity and the lights. And I went down to the examination room, and when I opened the door, the sink had been ripped off the wall, the mirror had been busted, the examining table, all the stuffing had been torn out, and it was just really bizarre. And when I walked around the table, crouched down in the corner was this very small young woman. She probably weighed 80 pounds, and when I introduced myself, she just turned around and kind of literally just hissed at me, and just the feeling of being around her, the impression that I got, the look in her eyes, I knew there was more here than just insanity. Something was evil. I could feel the presence of evil, and I literally just ran out of the room. I was kind of frightened about that. And I've met a lot of patients in my life. I've been a doctor for 20 something years, and I've never met any presence quite like that. And I truly believe that she was probably demon possessed. So that kind of has interested me over the years, and I've done a lot of research into apologetics, which is how you defend your belief system and your faith. And I've looked at a lot of all the world religions and a lot of different worldviews and philosophies to kind of look to see if there's evidence for some of this. And that's kind of where the book comes from. What I believe is hard fact and scientific evidence that helps you understand why these creatures exist, where they come from, where they get their powers. And that's kind of what inspired me to write the book. It's long. Right. Sorry.
No, that's very, very interesting. Wow, the policemen were even afraid to approach.
Oh yeah, they were. You know, they usually when we would go see these patients, the policemen would be laughing because most patients who had mental illness would be doing, you know, things that were kind of goofy and silly, and but these guys were scared. And I knew when I looked down the hall and there's two policemen standing there who are scared. And they were not in the room where the patient was with them handcuffed or whatever. I forgot to mention she had torn the handcuffs in half. I knew something was really bad, you know. And, I mean, this little girl, I mean, she probably weighed 80 pounds. She tore that room all to pieces. She ripped the sink off the wall.
This is one of the signs of a demonic possession, right? A superhuman strength?
Yeah, superhuman strength. That's right. Mm-hmm. That's correct. Yeah, if you look, there's a verse in the Bible that talks about a guy who was possessed by a legion of demons, and it says that they would put him in chains, and he just busted the chains off constantly. Every time they tried to chain him up, he would bust the chains and pull them apart and would escape. So that's one of the signs, is the presence of superhuman or supernatural strength that humans don't normally have. So
did you ever find out what happened to that girl?
No, I didn't. I never did. I rotated off of the emergency room back up onto the wards, and I never really got to follow up on her. So I never really found out what happened to her.
Wow. Wow. Well, I imagine there's a lot of people out there who are suffering from this kind of thing.
Yeah.
So is that the only person you've ever run across in your practice?
There was only one other that I ran into, and it was a young man that we thought he was in a catatonic state when they brought him in, and he was lying on a stretcher, and I went in to examine him, and all of a sudden his eyes popped open, and I'll never forget, it was one of those creepy voices like you hear on the movies, you know, that real guttural, and he just looked at me, and he said, I'm going to kill you, you know, it wasn't just a psychotic or a drug-induced thing. I mean, the malice and the evil in his eyes was just chilling. I think that's the only other person I've ever met in my medical practice that I thought was truly demon possessed. So,
wow, that's pretty creepy.
Yeah.
So, tell us a little bit about the book and about the character. And
the book is the main character of the book is a guy named Jonathan Steele. He is, you know, he's your typical kind of rough hero around the edges who has a heart of gold. But I gave him a, he has amnesia. He's trying to recover his past. He has a very violent temper, and somewhere in his past he must have been an assassin or a mercenary, a very violent person. And when the book begins, the book actually begins with some backstory about him that involves his childhood, and it involves his main nemesis, this guy named Robert Ketrick, who is a sort of an evil businessman toward the end of the book. But when the book begins, it actually begins in Mexico with the unearthing of a stone carving that dates back to the, you know, like 1500s or 1600s. And it depicts a very evil scene of a dismemberment of one of the Aztec gods. And the evil character, Robert Ketrick, becomes fascinated with the stone, and he's been looking for it. He's a teenager, and he helps uncover it. And in the process, he meets a man who is obviously evil. His name is Lucas. That may give you some indication where that's coming from. But Lucas influences Robert Ketrick to serve evil. And on that same day, you meet John, my main character, as a child. They just happen to be in the same area. And, of course, later on in life, they intersect once again. When Jonathan still has no memory, he begins to try to recover his past. And in this process, he runs up against a patient in the hospital, similar to this young girl I just mentioned. It's another man who claims to be possessed by the 13th demon. And he escapes from the hospital, and Jonathan Steele is released. He's doing better. He still hadn't recovered his memory. But in the process, I don't want to give away the plot of the book, he falls in love with someone, and this character with the 13th demon possessing him comes back into his life, and there's a tragic event. And so Jonathan Steele decides to track down the 13th demon and destroy it because of what it has done to his life. And that's where the story really picks up. He becomes, I hate to use the word, a demon buster, but he becomes a person who he goes around trying to help people who think they have evil in their lives, really so that he can find the 13th demon. You know, if he keeps looking long enough, he will stumble across the 13th demon. And the main story in the book centers around a small church in Louisiana where Jonathan Steele finally comes up against the 13th demon. And his real story is rediscovering who he is, trying to discover his memory, but also trying to decide, why am I here? Why am I really doing this? Do I want revenge, or do I really want to help these people? And that becomes his dilemma. He falls in love with a woman who comes, a scientist who comes to help him investigate the goings-on in this small town. And he ends up in a very difficult situation where he has to make that decision. You know, do I go after my revenge for the 13th demon, or do I really help these people I've come to care about? And he's not a very caring person. So that's what kind of drives the story, is, you know, that final decision, what do I do? You know, and we all kind of face that sometimes, but tried to give him some human characteristics and a little bit of a dilemma he has to solve. And to throw, I throw a teenager in there that's kind of a thorn in his side, and a few other interesting characters. So,
right.
Anyway, it's, I don't want to give too much of the story away, but I think it's got horror in it. It's got a little bit of science fiction. It's got some of this scientific evidence. It's got a little love story. It's got an interest for teenagers. It's got a little bit of everything. And, of course, at the end of the book, the evil guy, Robert Ketrick, that he runs in, with, you know, beginning of the first book, they come together in the end, and, of course, they have to face off. And Jonathan Steele finally gets to confront the 13th demon and do something about him. And I don't want to tell you what happens, but I will tell you that the reason there's a 13th demon is because there's 12 more. So there will be more books. So
yeah, that's just what I was going to ask. I know why you called the book 13th demon, but
And there's a reason why the demon is number 13. And if I give that away, it would kind of give away some of the storylines. But
right.
You know, I don't want to give too much away, but I just want to give people a little reason to go and read the book. Actually, if you mentioned my website earlier, if you go to the website, there's a link to a blog that my character Jonathan Steele has been writing for 6 months. Actually, I've written it, but I mean, it's him telling the story that leads up to the book, and you can kind of go through the 6 months of entries. He's been putting, you know, been putting them in there since really last June. But they kind of tell the story that leads up to the book. So that might give you a little bit of taste of what to expect in the book if you want to see whether you want to buy it or not or read it. So anyway.
Well, that's an interesting technique to have your character do writing.
Yeah, I just I thought that might be something. And also, if you go to the website, there's a little there's a movie that we shot, a webisode. These two friends of mine who are film students in college, and I wrote a little script, and they went out, and they actually got some pretty neat special effects in it that kind of blew me away, which gives a little bit of indication of a knife that is used in the storyline. It's a very special knife that has some sort of supernatural characteristics associated with it. So anyway, that's kind of a summary of what's going on in the book.
Okay. Well, you're listening to UFOs and the Paranormal Over Our Heads. I'm your host, Preston Dennett, and our guest tonight is Bruce Hennigan, and we're talking about his novel, The 13th Demon. Now, what I thought was really the main theme of the book was actually came out in a sentence on page 201.
Okay.
Which was when Liz said, Josh is asking, God is letting all this happen, all this evil? And Liz says, well, he could stop it at any time. But God allows evil to enter our lives for a reason. It serves a purpose we just can't see now.
Uh-huh.
Which I thought was really profound, actually. And I was wondering if you could expound on that a little bit.
Sure. That's a question as an apologist to, you know, I go around and I try to speak on a lot of these issues, and people always ask questions. And that's one of the most common questions is, you know, if there is a God, why do such terrible things happen? I mean, you know, look what happened just this past week with Virginia Tech and all of that. And why doesn't he just stop this evil? And of course, the question, that's such a complex question, you can't answer that in a matter of minutes. But one of the aspects of I think, tragic things that take place in our life or what we would consider evil or horrible things is it serves as a time to build our character. I mean, when you're faced with these kind of difficult situations in life, you're either going to grow and become stronger or you're going to fail and become weaker. And it's only by, you know, the analogy that I used when I wrote the Conquering Depression book is I talk about how when we want to keep our heart healthy, we have to exercise. That means we have to go out and we have to run or we have to get on the treadmill, but we stress the heart. We put it under a lot of physical stress. We just push it to its limit, and when it gets pushed to that limit, it starts hurting, and we can't. We're gasping for breath, and we think we're going to die, but when you stop and it's over with, the heart is stronger. So I kind of feel that same way about some of the things that happen in life that we think that are evil or bad. They can serve to grow us and to make us stronger and to make us better. You know, it's the very famous psalm from the Bible, Psalm 23, where, yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil. And it's the idea that we walk through these valleys, they are the shadow of death. They're so bad, we think we're going to die. Okay, it's the shadow of death. But when we come out of the valley, we're back into the sun, we're on the top of the mountain, and everything is great, we tend to forget to look back where we came from. And so many times when we go through these tragedies and these crises in our lives, we can grow stronger and be better people for it. But it's the perspective, sort of like Liz has, you know, we don't always understand. There's a mystery there as to why evil is in our lives, and God works in mysterious ways. But one way that I've always tried to look at it is every time I fail, every time something bad happens, I ask myself, what have I learned from this? What can I draw from this as positive? It may be terrible, but there's something I can learn from this to make me a better person. And if I can do that, then I've redeemed that failure. I've redeemed that bad thing. It becomes a learning experience. And I think it's only when we're unable to learn from it that it's truly a failure. So,
right. No, I agree with what you're saying. It's very interesting. I noticed that after the Virginia Tech disaster, really the country came together in love. And
that's right.
It brought a lot of love out of people.
That's exactly right. And I mean, look what happened after 9/11. I mean, I wish we could have hung on to that sense of community and caring for each other and overlooking our differences and reaching common ground. But, you know, we're typical. We're humans. We rationalize and we forget the bad things and we move on. And before you know it, we're griping and complaining because the traffic is too heavy or our coffee was cold. And we forget about the 33 people that just got shot last week by, you know, Virginia Tech. So, it's all in your perspective. I think it's important. I heard somebody say, I thought this was really profound. This guy his name is Ravi Zacharias. He's from India and he writes some wonderful books. But he said that the only thing more dangerous than nostalgia, in other words, keep looking to the past, is amnesia. So you know we tend to forget the bad things, but sometimes we need to remember them so that we can grow and do better things. So
right.
Anyway. Yeah.
Well, I think that's probably one of the reasons for suffering or it's a challenge. And I think, like, well, say if we existed on the other side in heaven, there's not a lot of challenges there. We're not going to be dealing with betrayal or a lot of things
right.
like this. And I think coming here is we choose this. At least this is my understanding that we choose suffering on some level to grow. Would that be an accurate assessment?
I think that growth and that knowledge is what we will take with us to heaven. I think that's what makes us unique and of service. Or, of course, I don't know what that's going to be like. You know, it's a lot of people have different opinions. But I think one of my Dr. Hugh Ross, who is the fellow that I talk about in the book, who founded an organization called Reasons to Believe, he makes an analogy that, you know, on Earth this is our exam. It's our study time, and you want to pass your final exam, because when you pass that final exam and you get to heaven, it's going to be the things that you've learned and the things that have built your character. It's who you are that you're going to take with you, and who knows, you know, what are we going to do there? I don't know. I mean, you know, there's a lot of speculation, a lot of questions about that, but I think the important thing is what we take with us as far as our knowledge and our love and the lives that we've impacted, because I think really, you know, all the stuff here is going to be left behind. It's people that are eternal, that are going to spend time and eternity, that we need to focus on and making a difference in people's lives.
Right. What do you think about near-death experiences? Have you ever run into that in your practice? Or
yeah, you know, I'm very interested in that. I was one of the things that I looked at is 3 or 4 years ago there was a study that came out, and it was mostly anecdotal, but it was published in a medical journal by a neurosurgeon. And what this neurosurgeon did is when he was operating on patients on their brains, and many times when you operate on a patient who has like seizures or something where you have to find the focus in the brain, they have to be awake. So the brain doesn't feel pain, but the skull does. So they would put them to sleep, open up the skull, and then wake the patient up, and then they would stimulate different parts of the brain to see if they can reproduce symptoms or whatever. And they found out that if you stimulate the part of the brain known as the hippocampus, which is the base of the brain close to the midline, it's kind of the underside of the temporal lobes. Anyway, it's on the bottom of the brain, that if you stimulated it, the patient would actually have an out-of-body experience, much like a near-death experience, that they would be outside looking down at the operating table, and they would see things that they couldn't possibly see from their perspective. So this neurosurgeon called it said this area of the brain was the seat of the soul, so to speak. And, of course, I mean, you touched on this earlier. Anything that smacks of the supernatural, science is going to automatically discount it. You know, they're going to say, well, that's great, but we can't allow that to enter into our lexicon of science because it's a supernatural experience. So I think there's actually a physiological basis for those near-death experiences. And you know, when you study them, they're particularly in children, they all have the same or similar types of experiences, even though these children may not have, for instance, heard of a character, you know, heard of Jesus or seen pictures of Jesus. They all talk about Jesus or they draw pictures of Jesus, and it's real interesting. I'm not sure what the answer is, but I do believe that near-death experiences give us a little glimpse of the part of us that's spiritual, the part of us that we can't define scientifically, but it's there, and many times it may give us a little glimpse of, you know, beyond what heaven's going to be like, so... In fact, I'm working on a book that it's not going to be in the Demon series, but it's going to center around a forensic radiologist. I'm a radiologist, and there are radiologists who help solve murders by, you know, x-rays and all that. And he has a near-death experience, and in that process, he sees something that he should not have been able to see. And nobody believes him because he saw it in a near-death experience, but it's very pivotal to solving a murder. So I'm going to kind of deal with that when I write that book, and hopefully it'll be out in about 2 years, but I'm working on that now. So. Anyway, it's a very interesting area, it really is, and I'm not sure what all the answers are. You know, a lot of scientists just want to write it off as biochemistry. I think there's a whole lot more to it than that. I think there's far more to us than just chemicals. I think we have a soul and a spirit. So,
well, it's interesting because science is getting closer and closer, I think, to accepting this. I mean, we've got quantum physics now saying that spirituality connects, and like you, that example you gave was great about, you know, science is found the seat of the soul, so to speak.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So it is coming together. And so science and religion are not going to be at odds forever, right?
I don't think so. I mean, it's interesting right now. In fact, this past week I was studying some articles that came out about trying to bridge this gap between quantum physics and the general relativity theory. But what is happening in the field of science right now, this is what's interesting, is over the last 20 years, when you look at cosmology and studying the origins of the universe, we keep seeing evidence that there's a creator. I mean, the universe had a beginning. The universe is fine-tuned. It is ideally designed for life, and particularly on planet Earth. And when you start looking at it, scientists call this the anthropic principle. It's the idea that everything we see has been almost built and constructed just so that we can experience life here on Earth and have life. And scientists don't know how to deal with this. I mean, it just blows their minds because it tells them that there's something outside of our reality that brought the universe into existence, and not only that, but is actively involved in shaping it and designing it, every day. And so there are, like in 1992, there was one of the biggest discoveries we made was called the COBE satellite discovery, and what it did is it measured the background temperature of the universe, and it proved that there was a Big Bang, and that's very, very important. Without a Big Bang, you cannot posit the existence of a creator, and all of life just becomes purely mechanistic. But scientists right and left were talking about, we're looking at the fingerprint of God, we're looking at the face of God, this is God. You know, they were just using that phrase all over the place. And now if you talk to astrophysics, they kind of use this generic term, the entity, which brought the universe into existence. And now the latest thing, and this is what I'll just bring this up briefly, this is this past week I heard this, is the idea of the multiverse, that there's multiple universes all in parallel with ours, and so there's an infinite number of universes, and therefore ours just happened to be the one that just happened to have all the right conditions. And So you don't need a creator, you don't need an intelligence beyond the universe. But the problem with that is there's no way to prove these multiverses, and there's only one single scientific value that we have that can even point us in the direction, and it's called the omega value, which measures the specific energy of the universe. And if it's less than one, then there's a possibility that there may be these infinite number of universes or the multiverse. If it's greater than one, then there's only one universe, ours, and that's it. And we've measured the omega value at 1.02. So right now, people are making all these, scientists are working so hard to get out from under this umbrella of the supernatural that they're just positing newer and newer, more bizarre ideas that are really more far-fetched than believing in a creator of the universe. But again, it goes back to the age-old problem that I've seen in the years I've studied this. If it's supernatural, we cannot accept it. But if it's within the realm of nature, we're able to believe it. So,
well, there's a kind of a dichotomy or, an enigma with the supernatural, because the supernatural, by definition, can't really exist. I mean, it's just something we don't understand,
exactly.
Right? So,
I mean, when you talk, the word supernatural means outside of nature.
Which is impossible, right?
That's right. And what it really means is we can't sense it with our five senses. Well, we can't see gravity. I mean, I don't see the wind. I see it moving trees. I've never seen an electron, but we know it's there. So does that mean it's supernatural because we can't sense it? I mean, there's kind of a it's really a philosophical decision. You know what I'm saying? It's not truly a scientific decision. It's philosophical.
Well, the way I look at it, I mean, you can label everything. You can know all the weights and the measures and the distances. But everything ultimately is supernatural because you can't explain
it. Well, that's what quantum mechanics tells us. I mean, quantum mechanics is basically what it boils down to is all you can do is give the best probability of where a particle like an electron might be. It's not, you can't say definitively that it's right here on this piece of paper. You can say there's a 98% chance it's right here. It's called the Heisenberg uncertainty principle. We can't ever be certain, really, of anything in that respect. It's always a matter of probability. So,
right.
Well, one of the things that I talk about in the 13th Demon is what I call extra-dimensional phenomenon, which if you look at talking about the demons and angels again and God as a creator, if the universe came into existence from the Big Bang, it had to come into existence from something outside of our four-space-time dimension. And that means that the creator is extra-dimensional. He's outside of our dimensions, and since he created the angels and demons before he created the universe, they are too. And so anything that's extra-dimensional could also be supernatural. Now, science now knows that when the universe began, there were 10 dimensions of space. You know, we know of 3, plus a dimension of time, which is our forward-moving time. But they say there was 6 other dimensions of space, which are still there somewhere, kind of partially collapsed, maybe having something to do with string theory. So science has no problem talking about these extra dimensions. But when you start talking about extra-dimensional phenomenon, like angels and demons and God and all that, they say, oh, no, that's supernatural. Well, I think that's semantics again. Where do you draw the line? So,
right. Well, a lot of the leading scientists, I think, are very spiritual, mystical people. And although they may not admit it, do believe in UFOs and ghosts mm-hmm. and life after death and things like this.
Yeah, I think there's a growing body of believers in the supernatural who are entering the field of science. For so many years, the early part of the 20th century, we were seeing just the opposite. If you believed in anything supernatural, you were labeled as an idiot, as an imbecile, and uneducated. And so that pushed a lot of people, I think, away from science who were not just absolutely naturalistic and empirically minded. And in the last 20 or 30 years, we're seeing a shift in that. We're seeing more scientists are willing to admit about, you know, spiritual matters and incorporate them into their belief system, and they're willing to. And what we've really seen in the last 20 years, this has been wonderful, is these fields of science that were always separate, like molecular biology, statistics, and physics, and astrophysics, have always been separate. They always had their own little turfs. And what we've seen is they begin to cross each other. They begin to apply statistics to biology and physics to molecular biochemistry. And when you start blending the sciences like that, it just opens up a whole new world of possibilities. And it really is looking at things from a totally different perspective. And it's made science much richer and more responsive and more robust and a lot more interesting when you do that.
It's really interesting. There's one interesting case I know of a haunted house by a lady. Her name was Doretta Johnson, and she lived in this very haunted house. And she sought a wide variety of experts to help her, you know, including religious experts and exorcists and parapsychologists and scientists. And what was really interesting is each of them had their own interpretation of the same events, and each was able to help in some way with it, I mean, using the tools that they had. And yet it makes me wonder what exactly is going on in the spiritual realm of it. I mean, because the scientists, they measured her galvanic skin response to see if there was something peculiar about her physiology that was causing all this poltergeist-like activity. And they found out that she had a galvanic skin response, a GSR of 0, which meant that she was somehow a very good conductor of this energy. And at the same time, the exorcists and the religious people came in, and they found out, you know, the history of the house and that there was a witchcraft practice there earlier. And things like this. And, you know, I've investigated haunted houses where homes were built over burial grounds, and this is apparently what caused it. And sometimes it's a use of a Ouija board.
Exactly.
I do think that there's evil or demons or something out there, because one case I investigated, and this sort of thing happened many times in other cases, these two ladies moved into an apartment which started to have weird knocking noises and odd smells and cold spots, and then apparitions and things were moving. And then one of the ladies started to have nightmares of murders and things like this. And she had one nightmare that was particularly vivid, in which she saw a murder actually take place. She was in the room that it took place.
Wow.
And then they turned the TV on that morning, and there it was.
Oh, my gosh.
And it was right down to the last detail. And I've had run across this in like five separate cases where people will be in a haunted house, they'll have these nightmares, and the nightmare comes true, and it's usually a rape or a murder or some horrific crime. And it seems to me that there's some evil force kind of trying to scare the wits out of them.
Well, my theory about that, and this is, of course, this is, you know, developed some ideas and concepts that I used in the book, but my theory is that these demons are real, they do exist, and they will use, since they are extra-dimensional beings, in other words, they can move in and out of our four dimensions, and they have, we know from looking at accounts in the Bible, for instance, like they have these strengths, these powers, they can take on different shapes, different appearances, and I believe that sometimes many of these occurrences are actually demonic in origin. And when you can pin it down to that, it is unreal how many times those places or those people, like you said, have a history of occultic, you know, tie-ins, whether, like you said, it was witchcraft, Ouija board, something. If you look in there, there's some kind of occultic activity associated either with the person or the place that really kind of opens the door for that kind of demonic influence, either in a person's life or in a particular location. And in the case of the nightmare that you talk about, you know, one thing that I kind of think is true about demons is they can move around. So they may know, now this is kind of terrible to say this, but they may know what a murderer or an evil person's intentions are, and they may move over here to somebody that they're going to influence and either in some way convey that, either through, you know, speaking or whispering or however, so that you may actually sense or see what's about to take place or what may have happened in the past. So that's, you know, I think all of the science part of this is if you look at the extra-dimensional characteristics of these creatures, whether they're the good angels or they're the evil demons, it explains how they can use that access to the extra dimensions and their abilities to pull off some of this stuff. And of course, their intention is to make our life miserable, you know, chaos, confusion. You know, they say Satan is the father of lies. I mean, they want to spin lies on us, destroy our lives, ruin our lives, do whatever they can just to screw us up. And whatever they can do to do that, that's what they're going to do. So I believe a lot of these things, or some of these things that you're talking about, may be attributable to that.
Right. But what's interesting is they're given free rein to mess with humanity.
That's right.
To a certain point, I guess, to allow us to grow. And what's really interesting is another case I investigated where a family was having problems with a knocking sound in their house, and everyone was ignoring it except for the son. And everyone told him, just ignore it because you don't want to give attention to this thing. But he was interested. He's like, what are you? What are you? And it started to knock all around him more and more. And then one evening he was in his bed when he heard it knock on his door. And so he turned on his flashlight and he couldn't see anything, but footsteps came into his bedroom. And then something came onto his bed and crushed him or paralyzed him. And he said he saw a big, dark, black form, though he later denied this or didn't remember it, actually, which is something I've run across before. They actually can take...
Yeah.
This amnesia, which was what I found interesting in your book, was this guy, Jonathan Steele, dealing with amnesia. Because, yes, that's true. And what happened in this case is this guy is not a religious guy. He's just, you know, wasn't into religion really at all. But when this force was crushing him and paralyzing him, he said he became religious very quickly, and he started calling on God and Jesus and all the religious figures he could think of.
Uh-huh.
And eventually, this force did lift up. And my thinking is, well, this kind of attacked him, and he allowed it to happen, so he could sort of strengthen his connection to the spiritual realm.
That's
ultimately.
Right. I think so, yeah.
And so ultimately what started out as a very horrific and scary experience turned out to be good.
That's right. And I, you know, and I don't think all bad experiences are like that, but I think they can be. We can grow and get something positive out of it. You know, that you're mentioning about the amnesia, that's another, not in reference to my main character, but toward the end of the book, when some of the other characters actually experience some of these extra-dimensional paranormal-type activities, we know that from science, again, we're talking about science, you know, that's one of the things we've been talking about, our minds are confined to our four dimensions of space-time. So it's really impossible for us to comprehend anything that takes place in other dimensions. I mean, we can draw a computer model. You know, you can make a computer show me 10 dimensions of space, but when you look at it, we can't comprehend it. So the way I handle that in the book is when people see these things, while they are observing them, they may understand what they're seeing, but as those extra-dimensional or paranormal events subside, then they can't, it begins to grow fuzzy. They can't quite remember. They know they saw something. They know, kind of have the gist of what happened, but it's the specifics of it is difficult for them to comprehend because they're extra-dimensional phenomenon. And I, just like you're saying, I think we see that a lot of times in real life when these things happen. You know, they may be a repressed memory that you may remember a year or two down the line of something that happened that you forgot at the time because it involves some type of extra-dimensional phenomenon that we can't really wrap our brains around for very long. So I think that's another interesting aspect of it.
Right. You know, that's interesting. That even happens with simple UFO sightings. People will see a UFO and they'll forget it right after they see it. And I bet that's true with ghosts and other things, too.
I think so, too. I think that's why we have so much difficulty proving it or having empirical evidence for it. That's why eyewitnesses, I think, can be so easily, many times, discredited because they, you know, as time progresses, they may get fuzzy about the details and they may start contradicting themselves. And so people say, aha, see, I told you, you know, you just imagined it or, you know, you had a psychological break or something. So that may be a contributing factor to all of that.
Right. Well, have you yourself had any what you would term a paranormal or supernatural experience?
I tell you one experience I had. It wasn't with a human being, but I was working on my second book with the 12th demon, which involves vampires and vampire clans, and it kind of explores that sort of alternate reality of these kind of the goth culture and all that. And so I was doing some work on my laptop. I was actually at the hospital in my office and on the internet and doing a typical Google search, and I went to this one page, and to this day I cannot find that web page. But it loaded onto my screen, and there was this sort of demonic figure in the middle of the screen. I can't even remember exactly what it looked like, but literally there was this palpable physical force that came out of the computer at me. I mean, it was just this incredible sense of evil, and I really felt like something was coming at me. I mean, it was just absolutely chilling, and I slammed my laptop shut, and it went away, and then I unplugged it. I took out the battery, so there was no way I could open it up and be on that web page, and immediately call my pastor. So guess what just happened to me? And he believed me. He said, yeah, I think, you know, you're writing these books about good and evil, and the forces of evil don't want you to write these books. They don't want people to recognize that demons may be real and that bad things are happening and that we're in the spiritual struggle between good and evil. And so they're going to do whatever they can to stop you and intimidate you. And I've had many experiences like that in the last few years where I really believe when I'm working on some of the stuff, like the 13th demon and the 12th demon, where I've run into what some people may call coincidences or, you know, just chance encounters, and I really believe it's the demonic force and Satan trying to stop me from revealing some of this evidence out there that they are at work in humanity. So, anyway.
I don't know. I totally get what you're saying because I've experienced a lot of that myself. And a lot of it good coincidences as well. So I mean, there's
there was a lot of wonderful, wonderful things, like the historical line that kind of runs through the 13th theme and came about purely by chance. I was trying to construct a backstory, and I had three different things that took place in three totally geographically disparate portions of the world in the past, and I said, how in the world am I going to tie these together? And I was just did some research, and bam, this one historical character popped up that had been in all three places at all three times that I had imagined, and I knew nothing about that, so it just kind of tied it all together and made that historical background very plausible and believable. So I was able to root it in, you know, in historical evidence and not just something I made up. And that was one of those, ooh, yeah, aha, that was a good feeling. That was like, wow, I'm doing the right thing here, you know. This is something good that happened. So,
I love it when you get those.
You get those little perks and those, I call them the aha reaction, where you get those little perks and little plus things that tell you you're going in the right direction. So.
Right. That's what makes me feel like there's exactly like you're on the right track and probably set up in a weird way. It's very interesting. Well, we're getting close to the end of our hour. We've got like 4 or 5 minutes left. So, did you want to talk anything more about your book, or
let me just make a couple of comments about it. I encourage the reason I wrote the book is I want people to ask themselves, why do I believe what I believe, and then what do I believe? And I really challenge people to examine the evidence, be open-minded, look at what's going on in the world, and realize there is really good and evil out there. And I believe God, you know, God created good, and evil is the fallen angels who are influencing our life. And we're caught in the struggle between good and evil. And so, you know, and if you read the book, you will understand. I try to cover some of those issues. But I want people to think about that. I want people, don't just take what you're told at face value. You know, be willing to research, and just like you're doing with a lot of the things that you're talking about, research, look into it, document. Don't let somebody tell you you shouldn't believe that, but make sure that there's some facts about that. One thing that I tell people about faith, you know, we think about faith as blind belief, but the actual Greek word that is used for faith means that you trust in something because you've seen the evidence. So you have to, you know, don't just put blind faith in something. Look at the evidence, draw conclusions, test it, think about it. Don't put your mind on hold. Don't check your brain in at the door. Use your brain and think about things. And I don't think there's any conflict between going into science and being a religious or a spiritual person or a Christian. I think that those things are not contradictory and not, so, you know, exclusionary. So, anyway.
All right. Okay. Well, you're listening to UFOs and the Paranormal Over Our Heads. I'm your host, Preston Dennett, and our guest tonight has been Bruce Hennigan. We've discussed his book, The 13th Demon, Altar of the Spiral Eye. Now, people who are interested in learning more about this book can check out his website, which is www.13thdemon.com. That's 13thdemon. Now, this is going to be part of a whole series, huh?
That's right. In fact, last week I visited with my publisher in Austin. The first book is self-published. I had so much trouble getting it out there through the conventional, you know, religious publishing and secular publishing. I published it myself. And you can order it on my website. And I got a group to help me with the marketing, and they have a publishing branch, and they said, we want to do your second book. So The 12th Demon, which is called Vampire Magic, 12th Demon, Vampire Magic. I turned my manuscript into them last week, and we're going to begin working on the process of getting that book out. Hopefully, we're shooting for February of 2008. I know that seems a long time away, but, you know, most publishers take 2 to 3 years. I'm going to plan to put a book out once a year. So it is in the can, and we're working on that one now. And I'm actually working on the third book, which will be about UFOs, believe it or not. So.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, very...
It's called Children of Another World. So the 11th Demon, Children of Another World. And I'm beginning to work on the backstory on that. I've been working on it off and on for the last couple of years, but I'm really going to start working on it in earnest and talking a lot about the UFOs and all the different theories. And I'm going to kind of take the same approach. I'm going to put the theories out there and let you draw your own conclusion, but I want you to stop and think about it and not just dismiss it. So that book's going to be fun because I can't wait to write a book about UFOs. So that's
I, for one, am looking forward to that one as well. I love the subject. All right,
yeah.
Bruce. Well, thank you very much for coming
Thanks
on to the show.
I appreciate it. And have a great evening.
Thank you. You too.
Okay.
All right, everyone. Bye-bye. That's our show tonight. You've been listening to UFOs and the Paranormal Over Our Heads. Our guest has been Bruce Hennigan. I hope you can join us next week when we have on Don Keating, and he will be talking about Bigfoot in East Ohio. Thank you all for joining us, and have a wonderful evening.